Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of January. Our guest this hour is a contributing writer for Mental Floss magazine, and they have a very interesting piece. They have a lot of interesting pieces always in the magazine. This one is from the January issue of the magazine, The Most Important Questions of 2009 Answered, or at least the questions that you think about and you wonder why not too many people have asked those questions. And they include, how hard is it to steal a nuclear weapon? Why is it there are a couple states where they do, at least the new buses have seatbelts, but why don't school buses have seatbelts? Are there places, this is a really interesting answer too, are there places on Earth that we haven't discovered, and why haven't we discovered them? And, what about going to space? When can we go to space? These are some of the questions that are found in the article, questions of 2009, and we thought we would ask them before the year gets too much underway. And Ethan is our guest. Our phone number, in case you have questions that are worthy of answering, and maybe they'll appear in a future issue of Mental Floss, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Or I guess you could send an email, too, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for you to join us. Ethan, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing?
It's just like you guys to come up with a list of questions like this that you read them and you thought, well, I haven't really thought about that before. So you must have just sat around and thought about, but you do that for a lot of these issues. What kinds of questions are most intriguing this year?
Yeah, we had a lot of people just trying to think up any weird question or just anything when you're walking around during the day you see and you wonder, wow, I wonder why that is. I'd never really given any thought before and came up with a good list, we thought, and ended up with these that we've got here.
Yeah. Do you do that every day? Do you wander around and see things and say, oh, I wonder why that works that way?
You know, I didn't until I started writing for Mental Floss. And now it's just sort of automatic that I see something. I bet that really has an interesting story behind it if you got down to it. So
yeah. There's a story everywhere, right?
Definitely.
Let's start on about – I thought this was an interesting question, and the answer is really interesting. Are there any places on Earth left to explore? I guess we would think that maybe the ocean – we haven't explored all of the ocean, but places on Earth.
Right. There are actually – there are a few – the ocean is obviously the biggest one. A lot of that is still unexplored, but there's underneath the Antarctic ice, apparently the last, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years has been a big thing. There's, you know, there's obviously the deep, deep shelf of ice on that makes up Antarctica. But underneath there is this apparently very, very hilly sort of landscape that's cross-cut by all these little rivers and lakes.
Hmm.
That no one's ever been down there because the ice is 2 miles thick, and the whole area underneath the ice is completely pristine because there's never obviously been any human pollution down there or any other sort of pollution. So the real trouble with getting down to it is figuring out a completely clean way to drill a hole through 2 miles of ice. So no one's really been down there. They have, I guess, different scientific methods where they can sort of image and figure out what's down there. There's a lake called Lake Vostok under there that's the size of one of the Great Lakes, but much, much deeper. So that's pretty interesting, I think.
And do you think that is there currently debate about whether or not we should do that, or we just don't have the technology to make sure that it's a clean way we go about doing this?
I don't think there's a huge debate about whether or not we should do it, but I think the scientists who study Antarctica are very conscientious about pollution, obviously.
Right.
And it's just they're trying to figure out the best way to drill down without introducing – it's not even dirt. It can just be bacteria or something that would be on the tip of a drill. So they have to find a totally clean way to drill down that far.
Mm-hmm.
But it supposedly bears a resemblance to a lot of moons and other planets that might be out in the galaxy. So they're trying to figure out exactly what it's like down there to maybe help form our views of what's going on in space.
Mm-hmm. And you also, what's going on in space, and tell me more about that. I found that intriguing. With the article ends with any luck, the land could reveal secrets about life on other planets. What kinds of secrets are you talking about?
Well, yeah, I think from my research, what it showed was that there's a lot of debate on whether or not there's life on Mars and what water there could possibly mean, what it could sustain, we don't really know. And especially because I guess it's the moon Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons, is really what scientists seem to think that the area under the Arctic, it sort of resembles that. So they're hoping maybe if they can learn what's going on down there, maybe they can understand what's going on better on this moon of Jupiter that obviously would be pretty tough for us to visit given our present technology, and maybe figure out if there's a if that could sustain life or not.
Mm-hmm. The other place, and you read the article and you know why nobody goes there because they can't, is North Sentinel Island.
Right. North Sentinel Island, it's this little island in the Bay of Bengal. It's technically part of India, but India doesn't want it. There's this tribe called the Sentinelese that lives on it. Nobody really knows what goes on with them because they're a very violent group of people. Nobody knows how many of them there are. There might be just a few dozen of them. There might be several hundred of them. But anyone who has historically tried to get near them to talk to them has just been met with a hail of spears and arrows. And a lot of people have been killed trying to get in touch with these people just so they can study them. I guess there have been a couple of incidents, even in fairly recent years. In the 70s, there was a documentary crew that was trying to visit and see what was going on, trying to film a documentary about them. And they got too close, I guess, and the director got an arrow in the thigh.
Oh, my gosh.
And they had to turn around. And then after the tsunami in 2004... Thai fishermen. They were fishermen from somewhere in Asia, had gotten too close to the island and got killed by a hail of arrows. And then the Indian Coast Guard tried to come in just to recover the bodies, and they were driven back by arrows. They're apparently very good archers. That's all anyone really knows about them.
Huh. So we have no idea why they live. We just don't know anything about them.
No, nobody knows their language, what they do, and it's such a small island, and I don't really think it would have any value for India to. I don't know if there are any resources on it. So, given how violent they are, they're sort of completely left alone.
Huh. Interesting. Well, we phone calls in and out of our conversation because we're talking about a number of questions, and when somebody has a question about the question we just talked about, it makes more sense to go to the callers right away. So we will, and go to Bob from Eau Claire, who wanted to talk about the first thing we were discussing. Hi, Bob. Hello, Bob.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I thought you lost me there for a second.
I thought so, too, but I didn't.
Good morning.
Hi.
Listening to you talking about Antarctica, many years ago, I was a student of geology. And if you think about the Antarctic ice sheet being 2 miles thick, then you can pretty much think about and envision what Wisconsin, Minnesota, northern Michigan, parts of Iowa, northern Illinois, and all the northeast coast of the United States looked like between, say, 100,000 years ago and as recent as about 12,000 years ago. We were covered by an ice sheet that rivaled what's sitting on Antarctica right now.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, Antarctica is the last great glacier left on Earth. Hmm. And all the other ones are receding. So that's just a gee whiz fact to throw at you postscript the thing.
Yeah, thanks very much. That's what we're talking about is gee whiz facts during the course of this hour. Well, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's move on. Although people may have other places on Earth that are left to explore, they may want to call in with their suggestions, but we'll move on to some other issues here. And one that has concerned a lot of people, some will say it is the most important question of our time, and that's securing nuclear weapons. You do ask the question, how can I get a nuclear weapon?
Right. We were just sort of being glib with that. We were just curious about how easy it would be for someone to steal one,
right,
basically, or to build their own. Which, to steal one is pretty tough. I don't know if people have tried, but they're under such tight security, and you need to have so much technological know-how, even if you got your hands on one, that there's so many locks and so many safety features and so many pieces that they don't store together to make it totally functional.
Mm-hmm.
That really seems like stealing one, while maybe you could do it, seems like the least feasible of any of your options. that you'd probably be better off trying to build your own, which again is something that would take a lot of technical know-how. I don't think most people could sit down in their basements and just throw one together.
Probably not.
But I guess there's the former Soviet republics. They already had so many nuclear weapons, and they had so much of the fissile material that you need to make new ones by the time the USSR collapsed, that there were just these large stockpiles of nuclear material that these poorly paid scientists could kind of sneak out in little batches. One guy took out, I think, well over a kilogram in these little 50-gram batches basically in his pocket, and he never got around to selling it. He was just taking it out and figured he would eventually sell it, and he got caught. But I think the number is somewhere around they had enough fissionable material to make 70,000 more nuclear weapons before that they'd never made. So there's a lot of nuclear material floating around out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess another idea is to find one that someone else lost, which is, I thought, really probably the most alarming fact, that it's not totally uncommon for a nuclear weapon to get lost. I guess in 2007, yeah, so just a couple of years ago, the Air Force had one that they loaded onto a plane that was bound, I think, from North Dakota to Louisiana, and they didn't realize they had put armed nuclear weapons, or not armed, but they had put active nuclear weapons on a plane. They thought they just put regular conventional weapons, and then they didn't realize this had happened, and there were no alarms sounded or anything until the plane landed in Louisiana, and the crew there realized, holy cow, we've got...
Yeah, holy cow is right.
Oh, we shouldn't have these. No. So... there's things like that, and then there are a lot of older ones that have either fallen off of boats or been on boats or planes that sank. In 1958, there's a thing that I believe is referred to as the Savannah incident, where two U.S. Air Force planes were flying off the coast of Savannah, Georgia, and they ran into each other, and nobody was hurt, and both planes were still flyable, but one of the jets or one of the planes had this Mark 15 nuclear weapon, this enormous weapon that, even though they didn't think that the nuclear part of it would go off, these bombs are packed with tons and tons of conventional, you know, TNT-type explosive, too, that while they're flying this somewhat wounded jet, they didn't want to have a problem with that, so they jettisoned it into the ocean. And now it's basically at the bottom of the ocean in a bunch of silt and sludge It's apparently, according to the Air Force, it's no real risk for it to leak nuclear material at all. There's no risk that it would go off, but they don't want to try to get it out because, as I said, it's full of this TNT-type explosive that could potentially be very hazardous, regardless of the whether or not the nuclear part of it still works.
Yeah.
But I know we were being a bit glib there that, really, even if you found an old, lost nuclear weapon, they require a lot of maintenance and upkeep. So it's not just something that you could stick in your closet for 40 years and would still be good. So
Right. You'd
probably be safe.
Right. Let's go back to that story of August of 2007. I find it unfathomable that a B-52 bomber can make a mistake and transfer, instead of conventional weapons, they're flying these nuclear weapons. What if something happened to the plane? From where was it, North Dakota to Louisiana? How can you possibly do that? You would think that there would be safeguards in place to keep that from happening.
I guess there are, and maybe they just messed up the number or whatever. It's probably one of those things, you know, that if it's something you do every day, you probably get a little more lax with it, and then eventually it just happens.
You also write about the number of what did you say? 1989 study said that there were more than 50 nuclear warheads scattered across ocean floors all over the world.
Yeah, I think that was from, maybe it was from Greenpeace. It was from an environmental group that had done a study in the late 80s. That, like I said, I think a lot of that is from if a ship had one in it and the ship sank, or if a plane carrying a nuclear weapon crashed into the ocean, that would happen.
Right. We're going to welcome more phone calls, and we have a lot more questions, the most important questions of 2009, found in Mental Floss magazine this month. And our guest is Ethan Trex, who's a contributing writer to the magazine. Coming up, well, we'll go to why won't Americans use dollar coins? a lot of other countries do. Why is it that we don't use dollar coins? And it turns out it's pretty expensive to have those dollar bills, or even $5 bills. Why do we persist in wanting those instead of coins, which we've tried and they just don't fly? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Rob Schroeder is answering our phone calls today. You may want to respond to the story that you've just heard, too. The one about nuclear weapons is fairly dramatic, I'd say. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ethan Trex, contributing writer for Mental Floss magazine, is our guest, and our phone lines are open for you if you'd like to join us in talking about the most important questions of 2009. 800-486-8655 is our number, and you can also join us by email, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. As we will be anticipating just a week from tomorrow, the presidential inauguration, you ask the question and start the answer with, presidential inaugurations are not frugal affairs. Do we know how much the Obama inauguration will cost?
I haven't seen numbers on that yet. I think for the 2004 George Bush one, they didn't really come out until after all the fun was over to say exactly how much it cost. But that one came in at about $40 million.
Ooh. Where does the money come from?
Well, most of the actual events are paid for with corporate donations that I guess each corporation can make up to $250,000. So the president and his transition inauguration team sort of solicits those, and that pays for a lot of it. Also, the tickets to things like the balls and the celebrations, they can get pretty pricey. They can go up to, I think this year there's one at the Corcoran Art Gallery that we had in the story that was, I think, around $1,000 a ticket to get in. So that helps offset a lot of it. For the major expenses, but on the other hand, the government obviously has to provide security for this huge event, which is not cheap. For the 2005 inauguration, the District of Columbia ended up paying $17.3 million for security alone, and that basically came right from taxpayers.
Wow.
And there's also another place where taxpayer money goes in. There's a Congressional Committee on Inaugurations, or a subcommittee, that gets, I think, $1.25 million for each one. So we end up putting up a lot of money, and then everybody's a federal employee in the D.C. area, traditionally doesn't have to go to work that day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a paid day off. That cost in 2005 around $65 million to the taxpayers. So it ends up being pretty pricey for all of us. So it's at least worth watching it on TV.
Yeah, exactly. It sure is. I guess you couldn't get to work, really, if you were a federal employee, right? Or anybody who's working in that area with the parades and the security and the huge number of people who are going to be there.
Right. I think it would be totally impossible for them to work. But that adds on to the cost pretty significantly when you're paying all these, in a lot of cases, very, very well-remunerated people not to work at all. So
right. Are you going?
No, I'm not.
No.
If
not
only.
Either. Maybe somebody should invite you. You certainly could write about it.
Oh, I think a lot of people are going to be writing about it. So what's one more voice? I could get in there and do it. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. So are we in, here's another question, are we in a recession or a depression? What's the difference between those words?
It's just sort of a semantic thing that economists do, but right now we're in a recession. You have to think about how the economy works in business cycles. Think about it like a wave, that it's always going up and down. Like, obviously, in the 90s we were going up, and now we're going down, and we'll eventually, even though it doesn't seem like it now, we'll eventually go back up. So a recession is, you get to the top of the wave, and then you go all the way down to the trough. And that area in between is a recession, or what we think about as a recession. So I guess the easiest way that economists think about whether or not we're in a recession or not is they look and they see if we have two straight quarters where our gross domestic product declined. And the easiest way to think about gross domestic product is it's just sort of the market value of every good and every service that we produce in the country. So right now, I think maybe it was last month, they said that, yeah, we're definitely in a recession. But a depression is like a recession, but on steroids. It's much worse. That everything just drops off a cliff. Instead of just a gentle wave going down, it's just sort of a precipitous drop. Unemployment goes way up. Obviously, it's terribly gone up now, but even worse than this, industrial production will slow down and crash. The stock market crashes, and there can even be currency deflation. So mm-hmm. that's sort of the easiest way to think of it.
Hmm. Here's an email from somebody who wanted to add to the questions of 2009. If the government took the bailout money and divided it equally among each person 18 years or older who worked and paid taxes in 2008, could that jumpstart the economy?
That's a good question. I guess that's almost analogous to what the stimulus package that they tried last year. It would probably be about the same amount of money, wouldn't it?
Beats me.
Somewhere in the same neighborhood. Areas. It might work. It's worth a shot. I'd rather try that.
Would you?
I'd take the money if they sent it.
Right.
I think you probably would, too.
I think so, too. And what will we do with it?
I guess then we'd have to go out and spend it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be stimulating anything.
Exactly.
Right?
Go out for breakfast. That's what somebody suggested last time. I liked that suggestion the best. Go out for breakfast. I'm going out for breakfast. Going to stimulate the economy. Yeah, that's a good one.
You know, everybody's got to do their part. That's it.
Exactly.
It's worth, pancakes are a worthwhile cause.
Exactly right. Well, let's go to the seatbelt issue next. Because that's been a big controversy. It seems like every state debates that every 4 or 5 years. In some states, not many, have mandatory seatbelt laws. But you really took this issue quite seriously. And is it your thought now that we probably don't need them?
Yeah, I at first it seemed to me when I started researching, like, obviously there should be seatbelts. I don't understand why there aren't.
Right.
But then to look at it, part of the thing is that a school bus is so much larger than a car that if something hits a school bus or a school bus hits something, there's so much more room to disperse the shock and the impact than a car has. So that bulkiness really helps absorb whatever impact you get, which is a pretty good protection. On top of that, there's this theory, I guess, that has always been around with school buses called compartmentalization, that if you think about when you were a little kid riding on the school bus, you had that really high padded back
right.
of
uh-huh.
the seat in front of you. So basically the idea is that then they're obviously very small seats. If there is a wreck, first, the huge size of the bus will disperse a lot of the impact. Second, if you go anywhere, you'll just slide forward in not very far into that really heavily padded back seat, which will help a lot. The only problem is that, obviously, if something terrible happens and the bus turns over, you have no help.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one downside of that. But another thing that I hadn't really thought about at all until I started reading this stuff was that even if you do put seatbelts on buses, it's really hard to get kids to do anything when they're at a school bus riding age, much less getting them all to put on a seatbelt. Would putting seatbelts on there guarantee that they all wore them? You'd pretty much have to have somebody, another adult riding on the bus who is just a seatbelt monitor or something of that nature. But even though it's really expensive, some states have decided that, yeah, this is worth the added expense, so we'd rather go ahead and do it. I think New York and California both have passed laws that if you get a new school bus, it has to come equipped with not just lap belts, but lap and shoulder belts.
So, oh, really? Shoulder belts, too. Ooh. Well, do you know why? I was just thinking about this as you were talking, because I was imagining the school buses and the rides in the school buses many years ago. Why are they all yellow, and why are they pretty much, you know, the same kind of shape all over the country?
You know, I don't know. I would assume the yellow is for visibility, for safety and things like that, but I don't know.
Huh. Because they are the same. I'm sure that when you conjure up the image of a school bus, you think of the same thing that I do.
Right.
And rode in the same thing.
Right.
School bus, yeah. All right, let's go to Scott from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thanks again for another wonderful program. I would just like to comment, maybe a lot of people already know this, I'm sure, but about the depression recession issue. Depression was a term that the Hoover administration started using because the previous term, panic, had such awful connotations. They'd previously been called panics. And essentially it's the same phenomenon as your guest has mentioned, but what they got this euphemism going because it was a depression in the business cycle. In other words, we're not in a panic. Don't you people worry about that. It's just a depression. And, of course, then that got such horrible connotations that now ever since then it's been recession. And this brings up another bugaboo of mine, and I hear it all the time. People keep saying, well, this isn't at all comparable to the depression, what we're going through right now, because everything was so much worse then and the unemployment was so much higher. Well, yeah, but a few months into the Great Depression, they didn't know, they weren't at the bottom. They didn't know how bad it was going to get. We don't know how bad this is going to get. You know, my understanding is all this thing didn't bottom out really until 1933, a full couple, 3 years into it. And, you know, why are we so sure we've seen the bottom now? I don't know.
You'll want to listen to tomorrow's show, too. We're talking with the author of Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle in the 100 Days That Created Modern America, much of which concerns itself with just what you're talking about. So,
hey, that's great. Yeah, and do please bring that up, would you, about where we are in the trajectory, because I can't buy this. On your program, one of the guests that was saying that, too. Oh, this isn't comparable. And I'm going, maybe not so far. Mm-hmm. You know, hope for the best, but... Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. You want to comment, Ethan?
Oh, I agree. We still don't know, and probably it's one of those things that you don't know until you have hit the bottom and start to get back out exactly how bad it's going to get. So don't know yet.
Right. Thanks, Scott, for the call. Brad is next. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm a school bus driver.
Oh, Brad, thanks for calling.
I was going to comment about my thoughts on the seatbelts on school buses quickly, if I could.
Sure.
Really, two thoughts. One of them is that it's very hard to make a shoulder belt, lap belt combination that fits such a wide-ranging area.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. You know, all the way from, you know, a 30-pound 4-year-old kindergartner to a 300-pound high schooler.
Mm-hmm.
And an improperly fitted seat belt is unsafe because it doesn't catch the right parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Although maybe there is some engineering that can go into that. And also the theory in a worst-case scenario, if the bus would be on fire from an accident or in the water upside down, many of these children would not be able to get their seatbelts off. And if, God forbid, the driver was unconscious or the aide was unconscious, there'd be nobody to get them unattached so they could get out.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. And what about getting young people to wear them? Would you, as a bus driver, find that almost impossible?
Yes. I mean, you know, you have... Most of the kids are good. Most of them would, but some of them would use them as weapons and whack people, you know. And I have a very good route, but kids are kids, and it's really hard when you're trying to drive to make them do what you want to, you know.
Oh, I imagine. It's not an easy job. Ethan?
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about using them as weapons, but kids are tricky.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Brad, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join us. We're talking with a contributing writer of Mental Floss magazine here on the Ideas Network, Ethan Trex, and they have compiled for this issue, the current issue, questions for 2009, including some very serious ones. And let's go to one of those serious ones right now. So if you want to follow up on any of the answers that we're giving or if there are other questions that you want Ethan to take on as we get rolling with 2009, I'm sure he'd be happy to entertain your question. Let's talk about this one, because the answer to this is good to know because it has implications for policy in the United States and for foreign policy. If the U.S. had to stop importing oil tomorrow, how quickly would we run out?
Much more quickly than we would like, probably. Right now, we're the world's leading consumer of oil. We take in about 20 million barrels a day and use them. We only make it domestically about 5 million barrels a day, so we're bringing in about 15 million barrels a day. That's a lot of oil. That's every day.
In the 70s, following the whole energy crisis, the government started to think ahead about this, and they built what's called the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's around the Gulf of Mexico. It's these big salt dome caverns that have basically been filled with oil. So if we have a major shortage, we have about 700 million barrels of crude oil, which sounds like a lot, but since we take in around 20 million barrels a day, that would only be good if we kept consuming at our current rate, which hopefully that would maybe be the finally something that would stop us and make us think, hey, maybe we should use less oil. That would sustain us for about 58 days, just what we have strategically socked away.
That's not much. 58 days. Oh, my.
Not that much at all.
No.
And you hear a lot about drilling in Anwar in Alaska and how much oil that could potentially net us. But really, reading the estimates, there could be anywhere between 4.3 billion barrels and 11.8 billion barrels, which, again, that's not a lot when you're using 20 million barrels a day. Those are the estimates, but that could keep us going for about a year if that was all there under Anwar. But we don't know if it's all there, and it's pretty tough, obviously, to access it. You have to drill, and it has to come out over a period of years. That even if you have some great huge well of it, it takes a long time just for the physical pulling the oil out of the ground. It doesn't just all shoot up in one day. You got to suck it out over a period of years. So if you look at what the United States Geological Survey says, there are around 23 billion barrels of proven oil in U.S. territory that we know are definitely there. So if we could snap our fingers and get it all in one fell swoop, which obviously we can't, we'd have to gradually pull it out of the ground, and add that to the 700 million barrels that we've got socked away strategically, that would give us about 3 years' worth if we kept going at our current rate, which is sort of scary.
That's a drop in the bucket, isn't it?
Three years' worth. Quite literally a drop in the bucket.
Right. Yeah. Let's go to Steve from Door County with an oil comment. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great program. Your guest sounds quite well informed. wish we all were. Question with you with regard to the Strategic Reserve program. What kind of thing, if it's made publicly known, what would the military do if they were in need of oil and gas if we had to use the reserve?
You know, I can't remember what it is. There's a pretty specific system. It was all laid out in the 70s when Congress created this, of how quickly we can get into it. I think there's like a 10-day turnaround, and within that period, the military and whoever would need it for national security can start pulling stuff out, and then maybe it goes to the rest of the country, I think is what it is, but I'm not 100% certain.
Okay. Well, that's fantastic. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Comment from Laura in Twin Lakes. I've heard that if you spend $1 per second, it would take over 30 years to spend $1 billion. I'm not a math wizard, but I've tried to compute it, and it seems staggering to me. This puts a real perspective on the billions and trillions of dollars which are talked about on an everyday basis.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that something?
That's amazing.
That is amazing. It's just it's impossible for me to think in numbers that large. It's large. Let's welcome more phone calls. Our guest is Ethan Trex. He's a contributing writer for Metal Floss magazine, and their current issue has a very interesting piece on the most important questions of 2009 answered! Exclamation point. We have yet to get to how. This is an interesting question that we've asked for a long time, and some countries are doing it. I think Israel is the leader in the world in this area. How hard is it to convert seawater into fresh drinking water? Another of the 2009 questions. We'll ask Ethan that and welcome more of your phone calls. Oh, and we got to talk about coins. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking with Adam Cohn. Adam is assistant editorial page editor of the New York Times and author of Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle, and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. All right, back to phone calls now for Ethan. Jeff from Minocqua is next. Hi, Jeff.
How you doing, Kathleen?
All right, how are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Just wanted to let you know why the dollar coin is not successful.
All right.
And it's very simple. My wife is from Australia. They eliminated the dollar bill, and the way they made the dollar coin was successful is you simply take the bill out of circulation.
Mm-hmm. I think you suggest that, Ethan, in the article, don't you?
That's really the only answer. I think France had a very similar, maybe it was with the five-franc coin and, or five-franc bill and coin. They had pretty much the same exact experience of, if you want to get people to stop using them, stop making them. That's really the only way to do it because we're pretty hard-headed about these things.
Yeah. What would you like to have? Did you use, say, the Susan B. Anthony coins, Jeff?
No.
No,
uh-huh.
You didn't.
But when I was living in Australia, you had no choice.
Right.
$2 coins was what they had, and you don't really miss the bills once you get used to it.
Yeah.
And then you find when you come home at night, you've got a lot more money in your pocket.
Exactly. The interesting thing is how much more expensive it is to print print bills, isn't it, Ethan?
Right, because dollar bills, obviously, they get circulated around so much. They can last for a year, maybe two. I think the average one is somewhere around 18 months. But the coins are so much sturdier, they stay in production, they stay in circulation for around 30 years. So even though it's obviously more expensive to initially make the coin as opposed to the bill, over the long run, you end up saving a lot of money. It would save $500 million a year in production costs for the government if we would switch from bills to coins. But so far, it hasn't worked for a number of reasons.
Right. So you would recommend, perhaps, that we just stop printing dollar bills?
Yeah, that would make the most sense. I don't think that will happen. There's a part of the reason that the coins have flopped so spectacularly here. Well, the first one was the Susan B. Anthony coin in 1979. But I don't know if you remember those, but they really sort of look almost like quarters.
Right.
So they were a real problem. Anybody working in retail didn't want those because you have one of your cashiers give somebody that instead of a quarter. They've made a 75-cent mistake right off the bat for you.
Right.
So it just felt like a quarter. It didn't feel like something different. Uh-huh. Then in 2000, I'm sure you remember when they tried to introduce the Sacagawea, and they had the series of TV ads with the talking George Washington from the bill. They spent $45 million marketing the Sacagawea coin. But I believe it's the coins are made at the mint, and the Bureau of Engraving and Printing makes the bills, and the people at Engraving and Printing have a really strong lobby because obviously most of what they make are the dollar bills. A lot of their livelihood is tied up in that, and I believe it's Crane, the stationer, who makes the paper, the cotton paper that the bills are printed on. They obviously had a very strong interest in making sure the bills kept getting printed, and the farmers who grow the cotton for that paper. There's a lot of levels
right.
to it.
Interesting, and you never think about those levels, do you?
Right, but because of all these internal politics, when they're spending $45 million to promote this new coin, they didn't want to make all the people who did the printing of the bills upset. So they couldn't say, you should use a dollar coin because it's more convenient and it lasts longer and it'll save the country a ton of money and really it'll be a pain in your neck right now, but you'll get used to it. They basically had to say, hey, there are these dollar coins. They exist. They're new. So without really being able to give anyone a very cogent argument for why they should switch, obviously nobody switched. They made almost over a billion of them the first year they were printed, and the second year they only really had demand for about 88 million of them.
Oh, isn't that something? Huh.
And I think now it's maybe down to like 20 million that they were – that by the end of the Sacagawea's run they were making. It tailed off quickly and precipitously.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff, very much for your call. I think you went to answer the door. I have a question, and I should take this to the bank, but I'm a little embarrassed to do so. So I'll ask you, which we're maybe being very public about this. my dog likes to eat money.
Really?
Yeah, I have a really bad dog. God, I love the dog. I just love him, but he's really wacky. And so he goes into my purse, and for whatever reason, it's just probably chance. I don't often have a lot of 20s, but he picks the 20 or the 10 and not the $1 bill to chew. But he never gets all of it because I'm usually there. It's my mistake to leave the purse open. And so I have now a $10 well, part of a $10 bill in my purse. But this one was weird because he didn't chew off the whole half. He just grabbed it in kind of in the middle and took out maybe 1/8 of the $10 bill. But it doesn't match up on the bottom, so it doesn't say $10. You know, we're missing the O or the L or something like that. Do you know, and I'm sure people get this as well, how much of the bill you have to have before it can still be a good bill?
I can't remember. I was looking at that on this. It might just be 51%. It might be a little bit more.
You don't have
to have the whole thing, I don't think.
Oh, you don't. So you can scotch tape it. If you have it in two pieces, it's okay to use scotch tape on it. And
right. I think a bank would probably replace that.
The bank, but I bet you'd have problems if you went to buy your lunch, huh? Do you
probably.
Think?
Probably.
Yeah. So 51%.
I think that's what it was. I can't remember.
Huh. All right. Let's go to Matt from Holton next. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Hi, Matt.
I have a comment and a question. First, why all the school buses are the same?
Yeah.
I'm not certain of this, but I would suspect there's only a handful of manufacturers.
Oh.
And they all make them the same.
Yeah. Do you know where do they make them? Do you know?
No, but I know the name of one of the companies is Laidlaw.
Yes, right.
Yeah, and right. That's all the buses I see here in Wisconsin are all Laidlaw. So.
Huh. Most of them are in Milwaukee, I think, too, but, yeah.
Okay.
All right, well, we'll have to find out where they're made.
Yeah, and then my question is, I'm wondering if this came up in the discussions for the article, is my question is, how long would it take to pay off the national debt? You mentioned in your last hour that it was something around $11 trillion, or one of your guests mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And I just was absolutely flabbergasted by that, and I was wondering, how long would it take to pay that off? And I'm going to go off the air and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I have no idea. Much longer than we would like, probably.
Right. It would take a long time, wouldn't it?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Huh. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. We need to find out where school buses are made. Let's talk about this because I find this fascinating, and it certainly would, if we could do it inexpensively, help out a lot of the world that needs fresh drinking water. How hard is it, you ask, to convert seawater into fresh drinking water?
It's a tricky proposition. It's not something that you would want to start doing in your backyard, but it can be done. There are a lot of ways to take the salt out of seawater to desalinate it. And people have been trying to figure this out since ancient Greek times, the best way to do it. Obviously, you can boil it and then collect the vapor and condense that. Just like any distillation, and that'll work. So a lot of what goes on right now is in these huge distillation plants that have been built around the Middle East a lot because it's very expensive to build one of these plants. It requires, I think, some of them cost over $1 billion.
Ooh.
Or even up to several billion dollars to make. It's a pretty big initial capital investment. So you need to be a fairly rich country or a fairly rich area, which is why the oil-rich Middle East has sort of been at the forefront of this. But I think there are some in Florida too, some smaller ones now, and maybe some in California. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing. You heat the water, and then you collect the vapor, the steam that comes off of it, and the steam comes off, and it is once it's condensed, it's purified water that's good enough to drink.
The problem is twice as
expensive to make a gallon of that as it is to make a gallon of, you know, the regular water like we would get out of a river and purify here.
Right. Do you see this as something, though, that will be commonplace because we have no choice but do this in the years ahead and to figure out some way to make it less expensive?
Yeah, I think it will probably become more commonplace. There are already 14,000 or over 14,000 of them in the world at these desalination plants.
Huh.
And according to the World Health Organization, right now, 4 out of every 10 people suffer from some form of water scarcity. And by 2025, 2 billion people will have less than what the World Health Organization considers to be a minimum amount necessary for a healthy and hygienic lifestyle. So it's only going to get worse. A lot of scientists do think that we could go a long way towards alleviating this crisis by managing what we have better, being more polluting less, conserving more, things like that. But the desalination right now seems like if that doesn't work, if all of our, you know, our better management and stewardship of our water doesn't work, then the desalination is the
the best of what we've got going right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mark from Ashland. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I have a question, and I'll take my comments off the air, but as I'm listening to all this commentary about recession, depression, bailouts, just this mass ball of confusion we got going right now, and I'm thinking, okay, we go bail out the big boys who sunk us in the doo-doo to start with. Well, first of all, they don't tell us where they did with the money. For all we know, it's over in Indonesia somewhere, sitting in one of those cyber banks. And the other thing is, we bail them out and get them all up and going. They're going to keep doing the same thing they've always done, sending our jobs across the seas. So we're just like making the drain bigger and faster. You know, why would we do that? I mean, a lot of us down here that are having trouble making grocery bills, you put money in our hand, and we would that would be hitting the economy right now. I'll take my comment.
All right, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Mark, for the call. Ethan.
I guess that's certainly one way to look at it, that I feel like probably a lot of people probably feel that way.
Mm-hmm. What's the story with Guantanamo? You asked that question. Why does Cuba let us have that space?
Oh, because we have such a great lease on it. I wish I had such a good lease on my apartment.
Huh.
In 1903, I guess it was following the Spanish-American War, Cuba signed a treaty with the American government that we could lease the harbor, the Guantanamo Bay area, for $2,000 payable in gold coins each year. And it said that we could put a 45-square-mile naval base that we could only use as a naval base on Cuba, and that as long as we had control of the harbor, Cuban trading ships could pass freely through it. And that seemed to work for everyone. In 1934, we did a renegotiation of it, and they added a clause that is really why the base is still there now, that the agreement could only end by mutual consent of both countries. So we obviously don't want to give up the base. Cuba obviously does, but since it has to be an agreement, it's not going anywhere. But Fidel Castro holds sort of a strong grudge against this. He hasn't cashed an American rent check, supposedly, since 1959. They're apparently all in a drawer somewhere in his office.
Oh, my. Isn't that interesting?
And that's really all they can do is show that they're upset by not cashing the check.
Thanks for your call, Mark. Let's go to Nicole from Green Bay next. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I work at a bank, and first off, you should never be afraid to ask questions at your bank. and second, I just had a comment about the bill. I believe that the Fed will only accept bills from banks that have been what we call mutilated if you have at least two-thirds of the bill.
Oh.
And a partial serial number and a full serial number without having my manual in front of me. I'm not 100%, but we deal with a lot of mutilated money. So
okay. Thank you very much, Nicole. I'll bring it to the bank. Instead of having it sit in my purse.
So it's not just you if they deal with a lot of mutilated money. A lot of people's dogs must like it.
I guess so. I just thought it was odd for a dog to eat money. But what's odd, of course, is that it's it's the $10 bill. digital television, is this, what's going to happen? What's the date again? February 16th, 17th?
Yeah, February 17th. It's funny because I've noticed over the last maybe few weeks that the government public service announcements regarding this have become, they've taken on a tenor of a little bit more desperation.
Yes,
you really
right.
need this converter box. We're not just playing around.
Right.
So we're going to broadcast digital, as they've said, obviously everyone's seen the TV ads, on February 17th. It'll be good for communications because even though the digital signal is, I guess, better for your TV, you'll get a better picture and better sound, it takes up less space in the airwaves, so it'll free up a lot of area that we can that we can use for emergency broadcasts or police can use to communicate, and that we'll have more room if we keep going with things like wireless broadband. There'll be more room for them, which I think everybody would agree is a great thing.
Right.
But if you have a TV, if you're getting your TV over the air via an antenna, and you have sort of an older TV that isn't equipped with a digital tuner, you need a converter. That they're not that expensive. They cost between $50 and $50, $70. They're not that much, and the government would give you a coupon for $40 off.
Yeah, and on that note, you go do it, right? People have to do it. We're out of time. I was just looking at the clock. Ethan, thanks for being with us. Our guest, Ethan Trex, contributing writer for Mental Floss magazine, and we were looking at their issue, The Other Big Questions of, well, the most important questions of 2009. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls and listening. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.